There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in His place, back where He belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So how do we do that? How do we enter into the conversations of the day as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we bear the mind of Christ out on the matters of the day? Let's face it, people don't need another piece of our mind, but they do very much need the peace of the mind of Christ. So I invite you to connect with us online. Our website is reconnectwithcarmen.com. We've got fresh resources posted for you there today. You can like us on Facebook. Let us know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. All right, folks, I'm going to lead off today with a little bit of updated information out of London. We now know that two of the first people struck in the London terror attack yesterday were Americans. Kurt Cochran of Utah was killed, and his wife Melissa was injured and remains in the hospital. The other two fatalities were a school teacher, Aisha Fayed, and police officer Keith Palmer. The 29 other injured come from 11 different countries, including the United States. Britain's Prime Minister, Theresa May, was rushed out of Parliament as the attack unfolded on Wednesday on the iconic Westminster Bridge in the heart of London. And then last night, her voice cracking with emotion, the Prime Minister confirmed what she called the sick and depraved attack had been carried out by a single assailant. We also know that that individual is deceased, killed at the scene by the police. She praised the bravery of the police and other first responders, who she described as running toward the danger, even as they encouraged others to move in the other direction. And then she said this: "The location of this attack was no accident. The terrorist chose to strike at the heart of our capital city, where all nationalities, religions, and cultures come together to celebrate the values of liberty, democracy, and freedom of speech." Sir Michael Fallon, who is the defense secretary, told the BBC radio that, quote, "The police are investigating this man and his associates. We now know, although they did not at the time, that he is a native-born Brit." He said they were checking urgently whether other people were involved. We now know that at least seven people have been arrested. And he said that we are working on the assumption that it is linked to Islamic terrorism. And we now also know that the Islamic State has claimed responsibility for the attack and claimed the attacker as one of their own. So according to reports, in addition to the sort of terrorism sweep across the country at six different addresses, a number of individuals have been arrested. But Parliament's House of Commons this morning was literally packed to the gills. You can see pictures of it online. They participated in a moment of silence and then the resumption of what they described as business as usual. And it's notable, I think, that the mayor of London, Shadiq Khan, I'm going to pronounce his name correctly, first Muslim mayor of London, has issued an open invitation to all Londoners and visitors to the area to a candlelight vigil in Trafalgar Square tonight. Actually, it's probably already happening. So the mayor is asking everyone to come together in solidarity to remember those who lost their lives, to express sympathy for the families and loved ones, and to show the world. Here's the Muslim mayor's quote: "To show the world that we are more committed than ever to the values that we hold dear, that we remain united and open. London is the greatest city in the world. We will never be cowed by terrorism. We stand together in the face of those who seek to harm us and destroy our way of life. We always have, and we always will." So I want to make a few comments about what has been said, and let's begin with certainly our thoughts and prayers go out to the families of the victims and to people who are visiting the city of London. I know there were a couple of tourist groups of kids, one from France, and several of those students are in the hospital. And so, you know, the fear that comes, I mean, that's part of what terrorism is about, is keeping people from going about doing the things that they want to do, like go see Big Ben or watch Parliament in action or walk the Westminster Commons, those kinds of things. And so gathering in Trafalgar Square for this candlelight vigil is an important thing to do. But candlelight vigil implies what? It implies prayer. And when you start having a conversation about public prayer and organized public prayer and organized public prayer in a city as socially and religiously diverse as the city of London, I think an interesting conversation emerges. To whom are we praying? What are we praying about? And what are we praying for? And who's hearing it? And how might we expect God to respond? And so when we hear the mayor say, hey, we're more committed than ever to the values that we hold dear, and then those values are described as unity and openness. I just want to ask you, are those the primary values of the British people today? And if so, if those are the primary values, unity and openness, then, you know, I think there's a challenge in terms of your identity as a people. And so I would turn the question on us. I would turn the question on us as Americans. If somebody said, hey, this is a threat against us as a united people, and we need to respond according to our values, you know, there's some question, I think, right now in terms of our national identity about what our shared values really are and who we think we are as a people and what we do hold dear. In what are we unified? Are we indeed one nation? And if so, are we one nation under God, under God's authority, under His blessing, under His providence, under His sovereignty? We're certainly always under His sovereignty, whether we like it or not. So we're going to get to that in just a minute in terms of the story about being a judge, but we're not quite there yet. So my final comment in relationship to what the mayor of London had to say was this walk-off line. He said, we stand together in the face of those who seek to harm us and destroy our way of life. We always have, and we always will. I got to tell you, always is a really, really long time. And so this concept that the city of London and its current constituency is the way it's always been in London is almost just farcical on the face of it. So I think that, you know, let's honestly engage with history and multiculturalism and the diversity of people who live in London now. But let's not say that that's the way that it's always been. And let's not say that we've always been defending this particular value system, even right there on that river, right there on the River Thames. It hasn't always been like it is right now. There certainly was a period of time before the British Empire, and we don't even live in a time of British Empire anymore. Even though they still have a monarch, they still have a queen, it's a really different deal than the always that may be referred to in that statement. Okay, so again, the response. The response is thoughts and prayers. That's our natural response as Christians. We are going to absolutely not only be thinking about, but praying for ardently those who are involved in this kind of terrorist attack. And so there was one British writer who responded with thoughts and prayers. But this British writer who responded with her thoughts and prayers happens to be an atheist. And so she actually responded on Twitter this way: thoughts and atheist prayers to everyone in Westminster right now. What a horrifying situation. She got pretty immediate blowback from those who read it on Twitter. The first response was, good job making this about you. The next person, Penny, mate, you could have just said thoughts and love or something. No need to shout, I'm an atheist, while trying to offer solidarity. And then someone replied, hey, thoughts and atheist prayers? That's just redundant. She replied eventually, good grief. How on earth is this an appropriate time for a petty internet flame war? So she says, show some decency. Okay, I think she misses the point entirely. But let me take this up for just a moment. Here we have an atheist offering prayers. I just want you to just pause right there for just a second. To whom is an atheist offering prayers? What does that even mean? It's a nonsensical statement. Atheist prayers? What does that mean? Let's compound that with this statement. When she responds, by the way, her name is Laurie Penny. She tweets at Penny Red if you want to see this traffic flow on Twitter. She replies at one point, good grief. Okay, I got to tell you, there is only one good grief. And that is grief that is experienced within the hope and knowledge and comfort of salvation in Jesus Christ. All other grief is bad grief. You can't have good grief if you're an atheist. There's no such thing. Because you don't believe that there is anything out there, and there is no one who cares about you, and there is no redemption, and there is no life after this. So this atheist who, first of all, is praying and then is declaring good grief, I got to tell you, maybe she's a closet believer of some variety. Because you don't declare grief to be good unless you know that you are a person who does not, who grieves, but does not grieve without hope. So there is my brief tirade on atheist prayers and the declaration of good grief by a non-believer. The only way that grief can be experienced in any way is in terms of it being good, is in the context of God's goodness. The only way I can survive an experience of grief is in absolute and utter reliance on the goodness of God. All right, let's transition to the next subject, and that's going to be today is the final day in the Senate Judiciary Committee's hearings related to Judge Neil Gorsuch. We have talked about his judicial philosophy. We have talked about his appreciation of the rule of law and the equality of everyone under the law. We have talked about his appreciation of the independent judiciary and the balance, the checks and balances between the court and the executive and legislative branches. I've told you that some of my favorite things that he has said is that, you know, he's not a legislator in a robe. I mean, he does not view the court as the appropriate place to, you know, he's not going to legislate from the bench. I appreciate that. He also said, hey, wear a robe, not a crown. I appreciate that. Like, he gets it. He seems to really get it. Now, he has said some things during his confirmation hearings that have troubled some conservatives. And some of that is in relationship to the notion that, you know, Roe v. Wade is the law of the land. And he has agreed when asked that it is settled law. He's also established essentially that Obergefell is settled law. And so I do think that folks just need to recognize that a judge who has agreed to not prejudge anything, any case that would become that would come before the bench, is the kind of judge we want. Right? We don't want a judge that prejudges anyone. And we really don't want a judge who prejudges anything. We want a judge who is going to understand the Constitution and be a servant of the people and our mutually agreed upon Constitution. So I just want to encourage your prayers in the final phase of this confirmation process for Judge Neil Gorsuch, as I believe he is soon to be confirmed on the Supreme Court of the United States. And then we won't call him Judge Gorsuch anymore. We will call him Justice Gorsuch. Okay, so I don't think you don't get any bigger hat, and the robe doesn't get any more black. I'm just saying that there will be a change of title, and it will be something, an office that he will serve for life. So, all right, the next story comes out of, we have talked about this briefly before, and that's the subject of Tim Keller. Tim Keller is the pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in Manhattan, New York City. He is a church planter. He is an author. You may know him better as an author than you know him as a preacher. But he is a mentor to others in ministry. He's involved in lots of ways, not only across the country but around the world, in helping to really cultivate the next generation of church leadership in the Reformed tradition. And so it seems perfectly fitting that not only would he be invited by Princeton Seminary, the oldest Presbyterian seminary in the country, not only invited there to preach something called the Kuiper Lecture Series, but that he would also be a recipient of the Kuiper Award, or the Kuiper Prize. Okay, so Abraham Kuiper is a Calvinist theologian of great renown, but Kuiper also was a was a philosopher and he was a politician. I mean, he served as the prime minister of the Netherlands. And so this is a guy who's not only theologically educated and thinks that theology is important, particularly Calvinism in his case, but he thinks that, you know, the sovereignty of God extends to every aspect of human life and all vocations and the government and policies and politics. So maybe no better person to receive the Kuiper Award than Tim Keller. And Tim Keller was to receive the Kuiper Prize for Excellence in Reformed Theology and Public Witness on April the 6th. It's an annual prize. It has been sort of misreported that it's actually given by Princeton Seminary. Actually, the Kuiper Prize is given by something called the Center for Theological Inquiry, which is at Princeton Seminary, but is privately funded and actually headed by a different board of directors. So they should be at liberty to give their prize to whomever they choose and have whomever they choose speak to them on the issues of interest to them as an organization. But in a scene replicating this year's Academy Awards, the Academy Award for Best Picture, Princeton Seminary has, well, changed its mind. And so they have taken the step of withdrawing the prize. Now, I have to tell you, as an alum of Princeton Seminary, I did my graduate work there and I graduated in 1993. I had to tell you that as an alum, I'm just flat out embarrassed. I don't have any better word for it than just embarrassment. But knowing Tim Keller, I got to tell you, he's probably not too terribly concerned about winning this kind of prize. I guarantee you it's not something he lobbied for. It's certainly not something that he needs. It's not, you know, some special credit to who, he's not trying to build a resume, people. He's actually in the process of walking away from the pulpit of Redeemer so that God can lift up the next generation of leadership so that it doesn't become some kind of personality called after him. This is a guy who gets it. So he's a guy who is striving for the right kind of rewards, not those that are attached, you know, like that you get your name engraved on something here, but that bear out the evidence in the world that, that you belong to Jesus, right? Tim Keller is a guy who's trying to make the name of Jesus known in the world. That's pretty much his gig. He's pretty much, that's what he's got going on. And so, I think it will be interesting to see him welcomed to Princeton Seminary to speak, but not be a person who is going to actually receive the Kuiper Award. So I imagine that in future introductions in certain environments, many environments, he's probably going to be introduced as, well, he was a would-be recipient of the Kuiper Award, which will probably garner much applause in many venues. So here's the outcome of this conversation. The president of Princeton has declared that the seminary is standing in prophetic opposition, not just to one, but to many Presbyterian denominations, including but certainly not limited to the Presbyterian Church in America. Now, why? Because all of these Presbyterian denominations that are now anathema to the people at Princeton Seminary, including its president, these anathema denominations do not affirm the ordination of women, or more specifically, do not affirm the ordination of LGBTQ+ people. Which is to say that if you hold to an orthodox theology, a theology that the church has held over the course of centuries and certainly has been held within Reformed theology, that which would have been embraced and understood by Abraham Kuiper, who we're talking about, whose prize we're talking about and lecture series we're talking about, if you don't affirm the sexual revolutionary's agenda, which, by the way, is not based in the Bible. There's no biblical conversation in any of these back and forth letters and accusations and concerns. None of it comes from the Bible. All of it comes from this hurts my feelings, or this is the way that it should be, and this is just wrong. Let me just say this. This is not really about complementarianism or egalitarianism. Those are two big fancy theological words that get thrown around in this conversation. But I think it is really important to recognize that that is not what this is about. The letter withdrawing the award affirms that Keller will still be coming to Princeton Seminary, to the campus. But this idea that it's a theologically diverse place is just not true. And Princeton Seminary is basically not affirming the theology upon which it was established and for which it is supposed to be contending. I expect there to be protests. Somebody is actually on social media calling for a preach-in. I don't even know what that is, but anyway, calling for protest when Tim Keller appears at Princeton, because some are alleging that his very appearance, the very appearance of him on the Princeton campus, is going to hurt their feelings. So I got to tell you, it leads me to ask some very basic questions about the Presbyterian Church USA, which is no longer the largest Presbyterian denomination in North America. So anytime you hear them banty that around, you should raise your hand and say, hey, the Presbyterian Church in Mexico far surpassed you long ago. So y'all need to stop saying that you're the biggest Presbyterian denomination in North America, because you're shrinking so fast, you're likely to be less than 1 million members in this coming year. And a denomination with less than 1 million members is statistically irrelevant. So, anyway, that's just a talking point for you later in the year when you hear somebody raise this concern. All right, so I got this. Should all PCUSA pastors be rejected because of any and every stance that the denomination has taken on a social issue with which they disagree? Because if so, my guess is most PCUSA pastors don't actually know all of the positions that the PCUSA has taken on a myriad of issues, including abortion. I bet they don't know that their denomination is for it. Or Palestine and Israel, that they're pro-Palestinian and anti-Israel, that they're pro-gun control and actually pro-ammunition registration, that they're pro-open borders, that they're in favor of government-supplied, taxpayer-funded universal health care. The PCUSA is in favor of wealth redistribution through a reform of the U.S. tax codes and financial institutions. These are the kinds of things that if you're a PCUSA pastor, you're expected to be for. If you're for all the things that the denomination is for. And so I look at Princeton Seminary that's got, I mean, a fat endowment. You start talking about hundreds of millions of dollars in an endowment for an institution. That's a lot of money. Well, what if we start talking with them about actually applying the PCUSA social standard to their endowment? Let's redistribute that to all the little dying PCUSA congregations across the country. Let's redistribute the wealth of that Presbyterians left for the preservation of the faith and the advancement of the church. Let's redistribute it. Let's get it out of the coffers of Princeton Seminary and give it to congregations that are actually proclaiming the gospel. Maybe even congregations that Redeemer Presbyterian Church is planting as city churches across this country. Actually doing the mandated Great Commission of Jesus Christ, whose church this is. Let me just say, you can't have it. This church does not belong to you. She is the bride of Jesus Christ. You can't co-opt her, and you cannot redefine her destiny, and she will not be sullied by your sexual revolution. Tim Keller may be the nicest guy out there proclaiming the gospel today, and he's doing so in a way that is winning people to Jesus Christ. People are going to be found in the kingdom of heaven because of this man's ministry. But Princeton Seminary, they're not going to give him a prize. Well, guess what? I don't think he wants it anyway. Hey, after the break, I'm going to be talking with Warren Cole Smith, our friend from the Colson Center. We're going to be talking about some worldview things. We're going to be talking about some movies. We're going to be talking about some news of the day related to, Tim Allen, and we got all kinds of stuff for you after the break. So I want you to stay with us. We have new resources posted for you online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. I'd appreciate it if you would go to Facebook and like our Reconnect with Carmen page. Hey, that's a great place to give me feedback on what you're hearing here. So, or maybe what you want to be hearing. What would you like to hear me address in terms of what you're having a challenge getting God into the conversation about? So what conversations are happening in the culture that you've said to yourself, you know what, I need some help. I need to know what the hook is into that conversation so that I can more effectively be an ambassador of Jesus Christ on the things that people are talking about today. You can communicate with me on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LeBurge. You can always post a comment on our Facebook page, or you can do so on the website, reconnectwithcarmen.com. So friends, this is a listener-supported ministry. What does that mean? Well, that means that in order for us to stay on the air, it would be great if you'd go to the website, reconnectwithcarmen.com, click on the Donate Now button, and keep us on the air another day. This is The Reconnect. We'll be right back. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect. We're putting God in his place back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So we're talking about what people are talking about, and we're talking with the people who are helping us talk about those things in a way that honors Jesus. So one of my great friends in this sort of apologetics worldview realm of ministry that's out there taking the things of the culture and helping us as Christians apply the mind of Christ to the matters of the day is Warren Cole Smith. And we have the privilege of talking with him from time to time. So his name's probably beginning to sound familiar to you. He's the Vice President of Mission Advancement for the Colson Center for Christian Worldview. You may also remember him as the Vice President of World News Group, the publisher of World Magazine. He's the author and co-author and editor of a lot of books. His most recent is one that he did with John Stone Street, Restoring All Things, God's Audacious Plan to Change the World Through Everyday People. You can follow him on Twitter at Warren Cole Smith. Warren, welcome back to The Reconnect.
Thank you, Carmen. Great to be with you. Great to see you at National Religious Broadcasters recently as well.
Yes, and I'm going to see you again in, 6 or 8 weeks at your event, the Wilberforce weekend. So I look forward to that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. May 19th through 21. And I'm not promoting it because we're sold out. 2 months in advance, we're sold out, which is really amazing. But it will be great to see you there.
Well, thank you. All right, friends. So one of the things that that Warren does is he puts together this thing called Signs and Wonders, and you can grab it at breakpoint.org. And this week's Signs and Wonders, I'm just going to lift up a few things from it, Warren, and you can talk about them. So Trump's budget, right? We recognize that it's a first pass. It's a first look at a budget. But you say there, if you're a conservative, there are both things to love and hate in it. So tell us what you mean by that.
Well, I think that a lot of conservatives like, for example, that it puts national defense at a very high priority, and that it puts everything, almost everything else, below that priority. So, for example, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is an organization that's probably going to get zeroed out, at least if the budget stands, will get zeroed out. In other words, a lot of funds for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting will go away. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, for some of your listeners who may not know, they are that's the group that gets money to National Public Radio and to the Public Broadcasting Service. PBS is television, NPR is radio. Both of them sort of get their funding under the umbrella of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Now, if you're a guy like me, conservative and also involved in the media, I think that's a good thing, because I think that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the organizations that they fund should have to compete on a level playing field in the marketplace of ideas. They should not be subsidized by the government. Your program is not being subsidized by the government. Breakpoint is not being subsidized by the government. So why should they be subsidized by the government? I don't think the government should play favorites when it comes to ideas. I also think that in the particular case here, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting funds mostly liberal ideas, many of them anti-Christian in their nature. So I think that one, for example, that liberals, or rather that conservatives, would like. However, I think where conservatives are frustrated with the Trump budget is that it really doesn't deal with entitlements. It doesn't deal with, for example, Social Security and some of the Medicare, Medicaid entitlement programs. And now, entitlement program, a lot of people say, well, they're entitlements. They are funds that we are entitled to. I've been paying into Social Security all these years. I'm entitled to that money. And there is some truth to that. That's part of the conversation that we need to be having as American people, is that, if you do pay into Social Security your entire life, it would not be fair for you not to get some of that money back. But I think the hard reality is that we are living much, much longer than we did whenever Social Security was first envisioned in the New Deal, right, during the Roosevelt administration. And we're not paying enough into it to keep it solvent over time. There are free market solutions today that didn't exist 75 years ago. So Trump does not even come close to dealing with those issues. And entitlement programs, unfortunately, now take up a much, much larger part of our national budget. And if we don't deal with entitlement programs as a nation, we're going to be in big trouble in the years ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, friends, the voice you're hearing is Warren Cole Smith. You can also hear him on Breakpoint from time to time, but you can catch up with him on Twitter at Warren Cole Smith and at Everything Colson Center. So you can go to the Colson Center website and check out what he's doing as well. So, Warren, one of the things in terms of like pushback and scare tactics that I think we've been seeing is that, like, it defunds Meals on Wheels. And I think that people need to understand, and you articulate this as well, things like Meals on Wheels, they're currently only getting about 3% of their operating income from the federal budget anyway. So these are things that are easily replaced through private funding. And in fact, Meals on Wheels has experienced a massive rush of donations since the sort of threat of its elimination from the budget. But I do think that reminding Christians that we do have a responsibility to take care of those who are less fortunate. And I think that maybe restoring some of that responsibility to the church would be healthy.
Well, I do too. In fact, I wrote an article several years ago that I linked to in this week's Signs and Wonders that described the day that I became aware of this. I voted for Jimmy Carter, a Democrat, in 1976 when I was 18 years old, the first time I was able to vote in a presidential election. It gives you an idea of how old I am. But a couple of years later, or some years later, I was sitting on an airplane next to a woman who worked for a youth organization called Campfire Girls. Now I think it's just called Campfire USA. And she was bitterly complaining about Ronald Reagan cutting funds to an after-school program that she was responsible for. About $125,000 that this mean old man, Ronald Reagan, had cut from this after-school program. And I, young and having it voted for at least one Democrat at that time, said, well, that's just terrible. What's going to happen to the program? What's going to happen to all these kids? And she said that, well, we've raised twice as much as what's cut. And that was when the light bulb went off for me, Carmen. That's when I realized that whenever we depend upon the federal government, the money goes to Washington. They take about 40 cents on the dollar to administer that, and then they send 60 cents of that dollar that we sent to Washington back to the local level. Whereas if we had just donated that money locally, and by the way, the myth that the church is not responding, that local donors won't respond, is just that. It's a myth. We have example after example, including the one that I just gave you, of local organizations stepping up and taking care of these that are actually doing good. If they're not doing any good, they deserve to go away. And if they are doing good, it's going to be the people on the ground at the local level, the ones closest to those programs, that's going to know that they're doing good, and they will support them.
All right, I want to change gears and talk with you about the conversation that you have had with Rod Dreher. So there may be folks who are listening who have heard of the Benedict option, but there's probably a lot of folks who have not. And so let me just start by asking the question this way. Are there different philosophies out there in terms of how Christians should engage the culture or should not engage the culture?
Well, yeah, absolutely. There are many options out there. You know, there are folks like in the 1970s and 80s, the moral majority, who basically included or advocated political involvement. And by the way, I advocate political involvement as well. I think that is a great option. And then you got people like James Davison Hunter, who is at the University of Virginia, who said that Christians should not be in politically, but we should have what he calls a faithful presence in the culture, that we should, in fact, have a moratorium from political involvement. And then you've got folks like Rod Dreher in the Benedict option. Rod Dreher basically says that, like the Benedictine monks of old who built monasteries whenever culture was in disrepair, we Christians should look for ways to live in that manner in the 21st century. Rod doesn't say that we should retreat from culture, but let's just abandon culture, but he says that we should build institutions and organizations in places of safety and peace for Christian families that would allow us not to abandon the culture, but to be healthy ourselves so that from those places of safety and peace, we can serve the culture. He calls it the Benedict option. By the way, his book just premiered this week at number 7 on the New York Times bestseller list. So it is getting some play, not just in the Christian world, but also in the popular imagination. Generally, he advocates things, for example, like Christian schooling, homeschooling, local involvement. Sometimes it's called localism. And it's finding some hearers in the Christian world and beyond the Christian world. And I will have to say that while I don't agree with everything Rod has said in the Benedict option, I think he's a brilliant thinker, a great writer. He's fun to read. And I think it's worth considering.
So, friends, I'm talking with Warren Cole Smith. Right now we're talking about another friend of ours whose name is Rod Dreher, and his book is called The Benedict Option, if you want to go check it out. We will probably have our own conversation with Rod about it as well, but I wanted to alert people to it, and because you guys hosted a symposium on this subject, and if people want to go and read a lot of feedback from a lot of different Christian authors and leaders on the subject of this Benedict Option, you guys have put one together, and it's called Top Christian Thinkers Reflect on the Benedict Option. And I found it particularly helpful in terms of understanding that he's not advocating a withdrawal of Christians from the marketplace of ideas. What I understand him to be saying, and I actually think the school example is the easiest one for people to understand. When we look at what happened at a public school in Maryland in the bathroom, and we are horrified by the fact that our public schools can't even keep our children physically safe from one another, let alone they're not being educated, and nobody apparently knew that a 14-year-old was missing from class long enough to be raped. And then we look at the situation in Pennsylvania, where the Alliance Defending Freedom has just filed a case on behalf of a young man who was told by his school principal and then on up the food chain in that school system that he just had to tolerate and get comfortable with a girl changing clothes in front of a girl in the locker room because they were an all-inclusive school system. And if that girl wanted to be in there changing clothes, then he just needed to get comfortable with that and make it as natural as possible. The offense that our young people are experiencing in public schools, at some point as Christians, we got to say, hey, our culture is so broken that sending our kids into public schools to be witnesses, I mean, that may actually be really, really dangerous and deadly. So what if we at least take care of our own and protect them from those kinds of environments while we are figuring out as a subculture how to more effectively impact the culture at large? And that's not a condemnation of every public school, because I've got a child in public school, but it is a condemnation of what's happening in some places.
Well, I think you said it very well, Carmen, and I reject too the notion that just because I choose as a Christian parent not to send my kids to the public schools, that I'm somehow, quote-unquote, abandoning the public schools. That is a false argument. That is a false narrative. But believe me, the tax authorities who take my tax money every year and use it to support the public schools, they know that I haven't abandoned the public schools. I pay for the public schools every year with tax money, and in fact, that money is going to educate other people's children and not my own. So I reject the argument that Christians who choose to take their kids out of the public schools have somehow abandoned the public schools. In fact, in some ways, we're supporting them more than ever because our money's going that money's being used to educate other people's children. But wherever you fall down on that issue, Carmen, I do think that it's important that we have the conversation in a civil public space. And that's why I'm so excited that Rod Dreher has written this book, The Benedict Option. And you mentioned our symposium about it. You're right. John Stone Street, Glenn Sunshine, Greg Forrester, Molly Ziegler Hemingway, Karen Swallow Pryor, John Mark Reynolds, a whole lot of really smart people have weighed in, some pro, some con, on The Benedict Option. But I believe that that's the kind of conversation that we need to be having as a Christian community, exploring new ideas, letting, you know, iron sharpen iron. Let's refine these ideas and let's take our best ideas to the culture at large and let these ideas compete for adherence in the marketplace of ideas.
Hey, before I let you go, Warren, I see on your website that although the Wilberforce weekend is actually sold out, you've got a pre-conference that's still got some space available in it. Can you give us the date? It's the pastor and lay leader pre-conference before the Wilberforce weekend, because Abdu Murray's been on the show and John Stone Street's obviously been on the show. And those are names that my listeners would recognize. And certainly the folks in the Washington, D.C. area could take advantage of this really great pre-conference. So can you tell us exactly when and where it is and how to find out the information?
I appreciate you asking. They can go to the same website, wilberforceweekend.org, and at the tab at the top of the page, just click on the pre-conference. And you're exactly right. That pre-conference is going to go from 10 in the morning until about 3:30. You mentioned Abdu Murray. You mentioned John Stone Street. Vince and Joe Vitale, who are also speakers with Robbie Zacharias Ministries. And by the way, if you come to the pre-conference, which is only $95, by the way, as opposed to $375 for the entire event. If you come to the pre-conference, we'll let you into the Friday night session of the regular conference for free, and that's Nas Guinness and Ravi Zacharias are going to be speaking. So it's actually a pretty cool way to be able to hear two great speakers in addition to what's happening at the pre-conference itself. The theme of the pre-conference is apologetics in the church. Why should we be teaching apologetics in our churches? That's what we're going to be making the case for during that pre-conference.
We love it. Hey, Warren Cole Smith, thanks for being with us again today on the Reconnect.
Thank you, Carmen. Great to be with you. God bless you.
All right, friends, it's time to go below the fold. This is the time in the show when we like to lift up stories and make connections that are designed to help you start and engage with other people in conversations that might not at first appear to be about God, but that if you are able to identify the hook in the conversation, like what in there is an eternal principle, something that I could point to, that I might be able to use this as a stepping off point of conversation with a person in the culture and actually turn the conversation toward things that really matter and ultimately matter, and in so doing, actually begin to change the way a person thinks about something. Just get them thinking a little bit differently. Hey, if I can get you thinking a little bit differently about something, that's a good achievement, right? Because what I'm going to be trying to move you toward is seeing the world through the eyes of Christ, thinking about the things in the world through his mind, where every thought is literally taken captive by him. So, there's a couple of movies hitting, they're being released tomorrow night. And, well, there's probably a bunch of movies being released tomorrow night. I'm only going to talk about a couple of them because they caught my attention. The title or an advertisement on television or something that I have seen in a review has caught my attention. One of them is called The Last Word. Now, The Last Word, just immediately when you hear me say that, The Last Word is... gosh, that could be about anything. Maybe that is about the last word that Jesus spoke on the cross. No, it's not. It's a movie that actually features Shirley MacLaine. Now, Shirley MacLaine believes in reincarnation, so the fact that she would be doing a movie about the last word where a really horrible old lady, and I say that because her character is described as relentlessly unpleasant, she's really so awful that she knows that her obituary is going to be really bad. And so to avoid that, she hires a writer in advance of her death to actually write a good obituary that she can pre-approve. Okay, so that's the premise of the movie. But what's kind of funny is that it features Shirley MacLaine, who, I mean, that's just a little bit odd because she is very outspoken about her belief in reincarnation. So if you believe in reincarnation, you're never going to have a last word. I mean, of course, you and I both know that your last word here will be your last word, but that's not what she believes. She's actually explored the concept of reincarnation in several books. She doesn't actually go to funerals because she doesn't believe there's any reason to say goodbye. And so it's just kind of curious that she would play a role that presumes that the end of her character's life is actually the end of her character's life. So I think that any movie like this, any movie that addresses the subject of death and even addresses it straight on and particularly addresses it in terms of just how vacant this person's life is of any kind of healthy relationship or meaning, and certainly any religion, is just curious to me. So the New York Times op-ed page has an article on it by Bruce Weber. Now, Bruce Weber is an obituary writer for the New York Times. And so his review of this movie is actually really, really clever. So it's entitled, From an Obit Writer, The Last Word on The Last Word. Here's something funny that he says. He says, well, Miss MacLaine herself already has an obituary. I know because I wrote it. So, I just thought this was an interesting approach to take for a review of a film about someone pre-writing their obituary from a person who has actually pre-written the obituary of the person in the film. So he says, an advance obituary is a staple assignment at the New York Times. It's a hedge against the inevitable. How are you, I am just going to ask this question straight out, how are you hedging against the inevitable? I think that's a really good question for us to be asking. You know, when you think about what your last word is going to be, we've talked a little bit about the concept of a last will and testament. We've talked about the concept of in England, you know, right? They have this whole elaborate plan put together when the Queen of England passes away, right? And they're going to say London Bridge has fallen. What do you anticipate your last word being? Who do you want your last word to be spoken to? What do you want the testimony of your life to be in the world after you're gone? How do you want to be not just remembered, but what difference do you want to make? I mean, part of the question for the Christian is, who do I know is actually going to be in heaven because of the testimony of my life, because of my witness to who Jesus Christ is and what he has done and what he offers in redemption to others? It's not, you know, are the people who I have loved in the past and have gone before me, you know, do I already know that they're in heaven? Because that's just a wonderful thing to anticipate in terms of my going to spend eternity with people I already love. But the question needs to be asked in reverse as well. Who's going to be looking forward to spending eternity with me? Who's here now? Well, you say to yourself, okay, you know what? That's kind of a bad vision of heaven. It's really all about having the opportunity to be with Jesus. And in heaven, I'm probably not really going to care a whole lot who else is there but him, because in the fullness of his glory, all I'm really going to want to be doing is living every moment in absolute, utter awe of the reality of the fullness of God and what it's like to know fully, even as I'm fully known. Like that. That just blows the mind to the point of not even being able to anticipate what heaven will be like. But you and I both know there's going to be a lot of folks there. There's going to be a lot of people there. Are there going to be some people there who are there because you shared Jesus with them? That's sort of the provocative question of the day. All right, the other movie that's coming out tomorrow night, and this is a spoiler alert, but it's also a way of letting you know in advance as parents that somebody's messed around with the storyline of something else. So there's a Power Rangers film coming out tomorrow night. It's another live action adaptation of a cartoon, basically. Okay, I'm probably not supposed to call it that. But here's what you need to know. The Power Rangers film, much like the adaptation for the big screen of Beauty and the Beast, features, I know, No shock here, a gay character. So the openly gay superhero featured in the new Power Rangers big screen outing will be a film first in terms of superheroes on the big screen. Director Dean Israelite told The Hollywood Reporter that Trini, by the way, is the yellow Power Ranger. Trini is, quote, questioning a lot about who she is. Well, friends, teenagers who are going to go see this film are probably already questioning a lot about who they are, but the answer to that question is not that they are anything less than God created them to be. And God created us on purpose and for a purpose, and so my encouragement to you is to help those teenagers that you know find their identity in Jesus Christ and in him alone, and not be searching for it in sexual outings with other teenagers, even though they may be superheroes. All right, friends, this is The Reconnect. We are totally out of time. I'll see you right back here tomorrow. Have a great day, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.